Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. A look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
Wall Street owns the country. It is no longer a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, but a government of Wall Street, by Wall Street, and for Wall Street. Money rules. Our laws are the output of a system which clothes rascals in robes and honesty in rags. The parties lie to us and the political speakers mislead us. We were told 2 years ago to go to work and raise a big crop. That was all we needed. We went to work and plowed and planted. The rains fell, the sun shone, nature smiled, and we raised the big crop that they told us to. And what came of it? 8-cent corn, 10-cent oats, 2-cent beef, and no price at all for butter and eggs. That's what came of it. Then the politician said we suffered from overproduction. Overproduction? When 10,000 little children, so statistics tell us, starve to death every year in the United States of America. We want money. Land and transportation. We want the accursed foreclosure system wiped out. We still stand by our homes. We will not pay our debts to the loan shark companies until the government pays its debts to us. The people are at bay, so let the bloodhounds of money beware.
Speaking the words of Mary Ellen Leese in 1890, actress Frances McDormand opens today's It's Our Money with Ellen Brown program. Greetings, I'm Walt McCree, Chair Emeritus and Senior Advisor to the Public Banking Institute and Ellen's co-host. McDormand's fiery portrayal depicts the resentment that the bankers of the 19th century fostered through their ruthless practice of usury against struggling farmers and citizens who were forced from their farms and homes as a result, in part, of monopoly-manipulated markets that undercut their profits and financial viability. You may recall that it was not 30 years later that the farmers in North Dakota, struggling under the same circumstances, decided to create their own public bank, the Bank of North Dakota, which will be 100 years old next year. In many, many ways, that situation persists around America and the world as private financial powers run roughshod over personal prosperity and public interest. This continuing drumbeat of inequity and unfair dealing makes the movement to create public banks all the more timely and relevant as personal, public, and global debt mounts, pushing citizens, families, and entire nations toward a variety of economic brinks. On today's program, we visit several of the key aspects and challenges that accompany creation of public banks, and where and how these considerations are coming into play. Ellen has recently completed a new article that pushes back against an op-ed that was taking issue with creating a public bank in Los Angeles.
Your article is called LA's Visionary Break with Wall Street, a rebuttal to the Los Angeles Times. And you start out by saying that Wall Street owns the country, a sentiment that was shared as far back as 1890 by the populist leader Mary Ellen Leese, also Franklin Roosevelt in 1933, and more recently by Illinois Senator Dick Durbin, and acknowledging that Wall Street really has been in control of the country for a long, long time, even though they've wiped out $19 trillion in household wealth, turned out 10 million families from their homes, cost 9 million jobs in the United States alone, wound up being bailed out without any penalty, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the list is long and we know it. So thank you for pushing back with such hard-hitting facts, Ellen. What do you think is propelling the Los Angeles Times to come out against this bank idea?
Well, they didn't actually say the bank was a bad idea. What they said was the measure was a bad idea. The measure asked the voters to approve a bank without actually saying what kind of bank it is, and that's the concern of the LA Times. But what I was trying to say in this article is that Herb Wesson is the city council president, and he really is visionary. I mean, he has said this privately, that that he sees this as a revolution, and that the country looks to California to act, and California looks to LA to act, and he knows he's going to get pushback, but that he just feels this is where we need to go and that this is important. And LA has had, they've had a lot of issues with the banks. You know, they got caught in those massive interest rate swaps, and in 2014, they had a measure, they voted to try to renegotiate them. But then after that, there's no follow-up on whether they did it, so I'm suspecting they probably couldn't. I saw one article that said Detroit is the only city that's managed to renegotiate their swaps, and that was only because they were in bankruptcy, and the judge of the bankruptcy court said to the banks, no, we're not going to let you do this. So the banks always win. They say, no, a deal's a deal. It's in the contract. That's what you perform. But it's okay to break contracts with labor, pension funds, et cetera. All those get renegotiated. But for some reason, the banks always win, even though the banks are at fault. SEIU did a study in 2014 that showed that we paid over $200 million just in fees to Wall Street banks. And they suspected that that was just the tip of the iceberg, because you can't even tell what fees they pay. A lot of them are in these private deals. You know everything the city pays for everything else, but their Wall Street deals are private. So the city council is peeved at Wall Street, and they want to get out of those deals. And they actually did, of course, divest from, or they had a motion to divest. They haven't done it yet because they don't have any place else to put the money, to divest from Wells Fargo. But then the question is, where do you put the money? So a public bank was the natural option. So from President Herb Wesson's point of view, the thing to do was to get going on this, and we'd work out the details later. And we actually have the details worked out, of course. So it's not like the plan isn't available and we think the plan is tight. But my response would be to that, about that the measure doesn't specify what kind of bank it is, that the California Department of Business Oversight is going to have the last word, and they don't give charters unless you've got proper capitalization, proper collateralization, you're protected against risk, et cetera. We were just up there talking to them last week. There was a meeting of the Public Bank Alliance with the Department of Business Oversight to try to get a special charter for a public bank, and they are really tough. They were sympathetic.
They were sympathetic, but they...
Yeah, she kept saying, now, I don't want to discourage you.
Right.
She would discourage us and then say, but I don't want to discourage you. It's like, right, it's a good idea, but you have to jump through this hoop and that hoop and that hoop.
Right.
So it's not like the city can just do any kind of charter they want or any kind of bank they want. They're going to have to be able to show that it's not going to lose money.
Yeah, so in the pushback against the LA Times article, you're maintaining or illustrating that it's a long way down the road to actually getting a bank approved, actually, but also, of course, that the referendum is not about the bank per se. It's simply to add a sentence to the city constitution to allow them to pursue a bank. But what's significant about this development is we're seeing, as we get closer and closer to creating the bank, moving through the processes, that there are already checks and balances in place that public banking advocates are going to have to approach from a very disciplined and a rigorous sort of a way, like any other business or any other bank, to be able to comply with the regulations that are on the board.
And the LA Times then cited the Los Angeles Community Development Bank, which was founded in 1992, and it only lasted a decade before it was bankrupt. but it was not a bank, and it was it didn't have to get a charter. It didn't have to jump through all those hoops. It was basically a big chunk of money that was handed over by the federal government after the riots in L.A. that was triggered by the Rodney King beatings by police. And so it was really intended to pacify these businesses that couldn't get credit. And so it was designed to make loans, to basically make subprime loans. And they failed, but it did serve its intended purpose, which was to show that somebody cared, you know, about what was how they were credit starved in the inner city, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But
and
we have a harder road to hoe, yeah.
As we mentioned, Mary Ellen Lease, in 1890, 120 years ago, speaking to today's moment about how people are outside of the economic prospect entirely, that the monopoly interests of money and industry and leave the people on the side of the road, you're quoting her as timely and insightful. She was in favor of the Postal Savings Bank even back then. But I liked her admonition at the end. She advised the farmers who were being put out of their homes and their farms to raise less corn and more hell. Isn't that where we find ourselves now?
Yeah. And you know that the Postal Savings Banks actually were established in 1911 and were very successful, particularly in the 1930s, at saving. People rushed to put their money in the postal savings banks because these were safe. This was when the other banks were collapsing. But FDR, who said in this letter to Colonel House, he said that the banks owned the government. FDR's government, instead of backstopping the postal banks and expanding their reach, actually propped up the banks with FDIC insurance. So we, the people, then were on the hook for the deposits in these private banks. So we're guaranteeing our own deposits in private banks. So if they lose, we're on the hook for their loss. So why did he do that? I mean, as he said, they are just too powerful. He couldn't overcome the pressures of the banks. And then Dick Durbin said the same thing. He said, hard to believe in a time when we're facing a banking crisis that many of the banks created, the banks are still the most powerful lobby on Capitol Hill, and they frankly own the place. I would argue that's because they actually create our money supply, and so we're inextricably, our economic fate is inextricably entangled in theirs. And if we want to get out of that, we have to set up our own banks. So that's the vision that Herb Wesson has and that he was pursuing. So the one way in which maybe he needn't have done this just now is that the provision they're trying to change says that the city can't engage in a commercial business. And the bank that at least we would recommend is not really a commercial business. It would be a public utility. It would be could all just be internal funds refinancing all that stuff internally and refinancing its own debt at a lower rate, saving a lot of money. And then the money that was saved could be used for all those things the city needs.
And of course, the public banking advocate's message is steer clear of competition by not going up against community banks for their audience. Of course, we know that the public banks can be enormously valuable to the commercial banks at various times in their business cycle where they don't have enough resources or they've got a lending portfolio that's too consolidated or singular in one particular sector or can't get liquidity. The public banks can become very good partnerships for them. But then it does come back to what you said before that we've talked about so many times, and that is the fact that our money is created by private parties. And that simple fact, the mechanics of how we issue credit in the country are what would seem to be up for revision.
Mm-hmm. Actually, FDR, when he in that letter where he said the banks own the country, said that they have owned it, or a certain element in the financial centers has owned the government ever since the days of Andrew Jackson. Well, Andrew Jackson shut down the second U.S. bank, and so after that, the second U.S. bank was issuing banknotes, which, like all banks do, were supposedly backed by gold, but because they could issue 10 times as many notes as they had gold, they were in effect issuing the national money supply. But after the bank was shut down, we only had private bank notes doing the same thing, where they would issue notes, but many more notes than they had gold. So they were already issuing the paper money supply through most of the 19th century. And then when they got taxed in 1865 for their banknotes, they switched over to the system we have now, where they would actually write the sum that was being borrowed into the borrower's account without, they didn't do the banknotes. So the borrower was in effect writing the banknote when he wrote a check on the bank's credit. And that was the system that collapsed in 1933, and that was way too tight in the 1890s, which is what Mary Elizabeth Lease's group was complaining about. They wanted more money in the system. So they were attempting to get the government to go back to the greenback system of Abraham Lincoln and the original system, the American colonists, where the government would issue the money directly and lend to the farmers directly.
What do you think of the contention that because the Federal Reserve itself is private and the notes that it produces are not government issue, that you have a situation that is unconstitutional because you have a private party issuing the money of the nation, that we're relying on Federal Reserve notes instead of U.S. Treasury issue?
Yeah, I think that's been litigated, unfortunately. So the Congress delegated that power to the Federal Reserve, supposedly, and they can also say it's moot because it was done decades ago. But it is true that the Federal Reserve is not working for us. They've said they're independent, but they're not really independent. Those interest rate swaps that the city suckered for, like all these cities have fallen for, were supposed to protect against the risk of the rate going up. And then when the banks collapsed, the Federal Reserve stepped in and pushed the rates all the way down to zero. Why? To serve the banks. So they were working for the banks. And so the banks had a massive windfall on these interest rate swaps, where all the cities and states were stuck with these much higher interest rates. And meanwhile, all their other investments, of course, aren't making the money that they used to make. So they can't afford to pay those rates anymore. And there's no reason to pay whatever, 5% or whatever, when they could get it for almost nothing.
Right. Well, the banks have not lost a beat. And as we said earlier this year, the first quarter banks made huge gains. And I see here now that the second quarter profits for Bank of America jumped 33% from the year before, largely helped by the Trump tax cut. Well, so there's nothing new then. It's just keep moving along.
Yeah, and we're still pushing on. But I suspect many people are predicting a collapse, a coming collapse of some sort. And I suspect when that happens, that legislators, the good of us putting these ideas out there, even if they aren't immediately acted on, or even if they've been out there for 10 years and haven't been acted on, the ideas are out there. People are talking about it. And then when the next crisis hits, they'll be saying, what about that public banking idea? I think it's time for us to get out of this private bank situation.
Well, we'll see what happens next, Ellen. To be continued.
All right.
We're going to stay in California for a few more minutes as we head up the coast to the San Francisco Bay Area to check in on Oakland, one of several California cities that are making pretty good progress in developing their own public bank. Reviewing these various municipal initiatives helps us to illustrate some of the main issues surrounding both our money and the banking systems that manage it. Again, who has control and how's it working out for the people? A former chief policy consultant for the U.S. Treasury, Paul Pride, recently joined the Friends of the Public Bank of Oakland to consult and help shape that city's approach to the public bank prospect. Paul has spent several decades helping pioneer new capital lending mechanisms for small business and minority communities, two important underserved sectors of the economy that he believes the public bank can positively impact. I asked Paul to assess the current status of public policy around these issues.
Well, I was thinking about this whole movement to create public banks, and it seems to me that the public banking movement is part of a larger effort to sort of fundamentally reform the banking and finance system. And I think that's been abetted in large part by the admission recently of the Australian Central Bank, Bank of England, the Federal Reserve, that the role of banks, as we've understood them historically, is not what really happens. I mean, banks are not neutral intermediaries between savers and borrowers, that they actually create money out of thin air. So what we've seen is the arise of groups that saying, wait a minute, we know now that banks are responsible for a lot of the damage that's been done, and this idea they can create money out of thin air is destabilizing and ought to be ended. You've got other groups saying, well, banking's okay, but we need to have more money created for public purposes by public spending. And I think public banking is part of that effort. It says, honestly, we don't want banks to create money solely for private profit. We want banks that will create money for the public interest, so that rather than having all banks in the economy creating money for fossil fuel companies and other extractive industries, further damaging the environment, and rather than lending to big companies or to large investors for financial speculation, we want banks that will lend to small businesses and for other purposes which are much more aligned with the public interest. So I think what I've witnessed is a growing awareness among people that the banking system is doing a great deal of damage as presently constituted to not only the economy, but to the environment.
And the public bank initiative in Oakland, where you're based now, is driven by which of those concerns?
I think it came out of the divest movement. This happened before I got here. As I understand, the city of Oakland decided some time ago to divest itself to a large degree from its relationship with some of the big banks. I think they have a banking relationship with Wells Fargo. I may be mistaken. But the divestment movement is a large part of what drives the interest in public banking here in Oakland, mainly because I think a lot of the people throughout California are concerned about the damage that big banks do by financing fossil fuel companies. And they wanted to have some sort of institution, a banking institution, whose activities were more aligned with what they see considered in the public's interest. Mm-hmm. And I often think about the fact that if you are making a deposit in a bank, you're actually lending money to that bank. The bank's promising to pay you back that money, but that money isn't yours anymore. When you lend money to a bank, you don't get to ask them what the bank's going to do with it. By contrast, if you borrow money from the bank, they will ask you what you're going to do with the money. So you don't have that reciprocal relationship. You have to you give them your money without condition. They're going to ask you a whole bunch of questions, including how you're going to collateralize a loan if you're going to borrow from them. So what I think people are trying to do is say, well, if we're going to lend money to the bank in the form of making deposits, we want to know what they're going to do with that money. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that the promises we get from the bank, you know, a deposit essentially a promissory note, are backed solely by the federal government. If the large banks in America didn't have that backing, or small banks for that matter, those promissory notes, which circulate as money, wouldn't have much value. So we, the taxpayers of America, the citizens of America, are backing the banking system, but the banks make loans solely for private profit. And so I think a lot of people think that's a system that needs to be changed.
What are the other issues that the citizens of Oakland are particularly focused on?
Well, you know, there's a huge problem with housing affordability here in Oakland. Homelessness. There's concern that because of global warming, cities here in Oakland and elsewhere are going to have to harden themselves against sea level rise and other catastrophic weather events. And the question becomes, where's the money for that? And banking is a strange business as presently constituted. Most businesses, if the product doesn't fit the customer, they change the product. In banking, if the product doesn't fit the customer, they change the customer. You know, if you don't fit their criteria for a particular type of loan, the bank's going to say no. They're not going to necessarily alter the loan terms to make the loan more affordable to you, to make it easier for you to repay. And mortgages are a good example of that. I spent a couple of years trying to find out why all mortgages in the U.S. tend to have a 30-year maximum term. There's no economic reason for it, none whatsoever. And as a matter of fact, in Japan and I think Sweden or Switzerland, at one time, people could get mortgages for up to 100 years. And if you think about it, houses last for 100 years. People's working lives extend beyond 30 years. So there's no reason to limit mortgages to 30 years. And if you had longer-term mortgages, 60, 70 years, the monthly payments that people have to put out for home ownership would decline dramatically. Well, a public bank could make longer-term mortgages. You're not going to get Wells Fargo or most lenders, conventional lenders, to do that. But a public bank could easily experiment with longer-term mortgages that would bring housing within the reach of more families. So that's sort of an example of what I think promise of the potential for a public bank offers.
You also were involved in working around the idea or the concern that minority entrepreneurial capabilities were dramatically limited by the lack of access to capital.
Right. Most banks are very reluctant to lend to small and minority businesses, especially new businesses, which don't have a lot of capital. And, you know, among minority businesses, especially African-American businesses, the lack of inherited wealth means that a lot of entrepreneurs don't have a lot of money to put into their businesses. Well, from the standpoint of a bank, this creates more risk, and they're inclined to say no to people who apply for business loans. My view is that public bank could be much more creative. And by offering loans on terms that ensure or make it more likely that the entrepreneur can repay the loan, longer terms, lower interest rates, using cross subsidies, for example, to keep the rates very low. For example, you may lend to major business or to some businesses at 5% in order to lend to others at 2% if you needed to get an overall yield of, let's say, 3% or 3.5%. So you have to be creative, and I think that's very important. One thing about a public bank, you cannot think in entirely conventional terms about how a public bank is capitalized, where the deposits come from, what types of assets it holds. You've got to look around for creative ways to solve the problems that communities that sponsor these banks have.
You describe longer-term mortgages and riskier loans for in the affordable housing market. How do you assuage the concerns that the public bank is setting itself up to fail with that sort of a profile?
Well, you know, there are ways to insure loans, one of which is pretty popular around the country and here in California, and it provides a model for how you can insure yourself against loss. For example, I might make a loan to you for $100,000 on the condition that you put up 4% of the loan amount in an insurance fund, and that, along with similar amounts contributed by other borrowers, could be put into an insurance fund that pays the losses on an entire portfolio of loans.
Mm-hmm.
That's worked in several states as a way of providing protection against loan losses.
Right.
So what one has to do is to find creative ways to look at problems of credit risk, interest rate risk, and all the risks that banks try to protect themselves against, and come up with ways of using those tools to help people who really need help rather than for financial speculation or private profit. You know, Wall Street's great at coming up with all sorts of creative ways to manage and transfer credit risk and to insure against loan losses when it comes to huge portfolios and large borrowers. So it's not a lack of intellectual capacity or ways of solving these problems, is that we've just got to use these instruments and some of this creativity to solve the country's real problems rather than just make a lot of money for people who are already rich.
a really good response, Paul, in that it describes the horizon of possibility for public banks in a much broader way. I know that there is typically, and certainly from the standpoint of the critics of public banking, they always look at it in the context of how commercial banks work and how they must work to survive, perhaps, but also some of the regulatory constraints and other things that you suggested are would be different about a public bank.
Now, one of the problems, I noticed this, I just read the executive summary of San Francisco's task force on public banking. And the task force comprised a group of really capable people, really smart people. They came up with a financial model for the public bank, and from what I can tell, the assumptions they used suggest that the public bank will have $500 million of assets after 10 years. Well, that's a big problem. It's much too small. And I think one of the things we public banking advocates have to remember is that it doesn't make sense to think small when it comes to public banking. If you look at the German public banking system, it has about 12% of the assets of the entire banking system in Germany. Now, if you translate that into the U.S., that means that a public banking system here in the U.S. should have around $2 trillion in assets. So we shouldn't be thinking about $500 million banks. Or here in California, we should think in terms of $200 billion or $100 billion. Not only because that means that it can do a lot more to help people, but it becomes financially more stable. Bigger banks have more revenue, are better able to manage all sorts of risks. That's why, historically speaking, big banks like Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan Chase have had to hold less capital against their assets than smaller banks.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to think big for a variety of reasons, not small. In addition, who's going to be inspired by a small idea? I mean, you can't get a lot of people excited about a $500 million bank. So
right.
I would urge everybody who's interested in public banking to think big. I mean, it doesn't take any more effort to start a big bank and to think about how to make that work than it does to start a small bank.
That's very good advice. I must say we are aware, too, that these banks need to be able to do more than just kick the can down the road. They really need to position themselves to transform the conditions that they're meant to
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I pointed out to people here that three or four companies in the Bay Area, Google, Apple, Facebook, maybe a couple of others, have on their balance sheets $500 billion in cash. $500 billion, with a B.
Hmm.
Why can't, if they decided, since they contribute to the problems the Bay Area has, that they wanted to do something, they could take 1% of those assets and capitalize a system of public banks.
Yeah.
Those banks would be able to make, $40, $50 billion worth of loans. I mean, that's the scale at which we ought to be thinking. So public banks, if we free our imaginations and just look at what the tools are that are available in the financial sector to manage risk, to make new types of loans. A public bank could use those in creative ways for the public interest rather than for private profit. So once again, it's very important not to look at a public bank as just a public version of a conventional commercial bank. If you do that, you're not going to solve the problems that are so important for us to address, either in terms of the environment or in terms of economic inequality. So we just have to be more creative and more resourceful in the way we approach this idea.
That's Paul Pride, former chief policy consultant for the U.S. Treasury, economist, and now a member of the Friends of the Public Bank of Oakland. You've heard us talk about turning money into a public utility, not unlike water, power, and other essentials of community life. This idea challenges the prevailing reality that money is treated as a privately owned commodity, issued at interest by a privileged banking cartel. In step 4 of his new book, Seven Steps to Global Economic and Spiritual Transformation, our behind-the-curtain commentator Bob Bowes discusses how it's possible to make the transition to utility status and what will be required.
In this segment, Step 4, Making Money a Public Utility Through Sustainable Economics, we discuss the private banking cartel's admission that they can't compete with public banks and thus seek to destroy them by hook or crook. And we provide a model for a sustainable economy and stable currency based on a network of public banks, including the central bank and regional, state, county, and municipal banks, all working within an environment where interest is prohibited. This is a frightening proposition to the Anglo-Euro-American banking cartel because, despite their propaganda claiming that public banking doesn't work, they know that a public banking network would be the death knell for their con game by which they control much of the world. For example, when President Lincoln began printing sovereign U.S. currency, nicknamed greenbacks at the time, for the color of one side, the London Times printed the following editorial, quote, "If this mischievous financial policy, which has its origin in North America, shall become enderated down to a fixture, then that government will furnish its own money without cost. It will pay off debts and be without debt. It will have all the money necessary to carry on its commerce. It will become prosperous without precedent in the history of the world. The brains and wealth of all countries will go to North America. That country must be destroyed, or it will destroy every monarchy on the globe." End quote. Hazard Circular, London Times, 1865. The corporate financial crime syndicate is still trying to outlaw public banks. During its long, torturous attempts to muscle the world into accepting the TPP, TTIP, and other acts of war posing as treaties, Barbara Weissel, the United States Trade Representative's chief TPP negotiator, stated that state-owned enterprises are routinely, quote, "competing directly with private enterprises and often in a way that is considered unfair." End quote. What Weissel is attempting to promote is the notion that a small group of private profiteers should hijack sovereign functions such as coining money, raising an army, managing postal services, building roads, and more, all sovereign powers assigned to the government by Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution. In other words, what Weissel is selling is one of the textbook definitions of fascism, corporate control over the state. One of her ilk's chief targets is the Bank of North Dakota, the only publicly owned bank in the U.S., and the chief reason why that state was generally unaffected by the 2008 crash. In fact, North Dakota runs a budget surplus, has no bank failures, and has the lowest unemployment in the nation. Just imagine what would be possible if the central bank of the U.S. were publicly owned, in addition to publicly owned regional, state, county, and municipal banks. In our book, we did just that, showing that a sustainable economy, stable currency, and progressive evolutionary society is only possible with such a system. Some may find this remarkable, lacking the understanding of how much productive capacity of American labor is stolen by global capital. The late Danish economist Margaret Kennedy estimated that up to 40% of the cost of goods and services in the current system is due to the effects of latent interest charges. In addition, the inflation of prices is also fueled by the profiteering of global capital on war, healthcare, education, housing, and virtually everything else. The power to maintain this thievery stems from private control over the key central banks. The return of public control over our central bank and currency would, in short order, just as the 1865 editorial in the London Times claims, put the cartel out of business and eliminate its massive crimes against humanity and its theft of the value created by labor, making universal income, universal health care, and universal education easily affordable, while at the same time shortening the work week as machines, computers, robots, and artificial intelligence replace menial and repetitive jobs. This would not only fulfill a long-time dream of humanity, but finish the work begun in 33 AD when the Senate of the Roman Empire was wholly comprised of usurers. It's now our turn to pick up the whip and drive the money changers from the temple of democracy. It's time for a new social contract. From behind the curtain, this is Bob Bowes.
Bob Bowes' new book, Seven Steps to Global and Spiritual Transformation, is available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other book retailers. Okay, enough already about banking. Let's contemplate what money truly is, what it could be, and how a paradigm shift in our thinking can free us from the false tyranny of scarcity to discover a world of abundance, if we would only use a proper accounting ledger. Ellen and I spoke with the author of a new book called The Economy of Well-Being, Mark Anielski.
Well, the economy of well-being is based on the notion that the word wealth means the conditions of well-being from the Old English. And with my accounting and economics and forestry background, the notion that money as an instrument of the economy and transactions should ultimately be connected to these conditions of well-being, real wealth, properly defined. So then the question is, if in fact each individual person, the human being, is comprised of what? About 750,000 hours of life energy is how many hours you'll live if you live to 83 years of age, the average life expectancy, and that we all have individual gifts, skills, assets, that the economy of well-being is based on the sharing and an ecosystem of interrelationships of people and planet in a stewardship model, which says the goal of this economy is to ensure human flourishing and ecological flourishing and resilience, which is the hallmark of a good balance sheet. So here I'll bring in the accounting side of things. What are our assets? What are our risks to our well-being, i.e. our liabilities? What is our equity? How is wealth, well-being distributed? So properly constructed, an economy should ultimately be based on an operating model where the goal is to improve the conditions of well-being for everyone to ensure there's flourishing. What does flourishing mean? Means basically, are your assets resilient? Is the land healthy? Are the waters healthy? Are your lives healthy? Are your kids healthy? All these things can be accounted for within an operating system that ties in the monetary policies and budgets of governments to well-being. So if you like, well-being ROI is the ultimate bottom line. I could show you that all of these things are possible within the existing accounting system that we've had for 500 years. The book is full of examples of where these experiments in Tahiti, my trip to London, England, little towns in Alberta where we're experimenting with the model, including in the workplace itself. So well-being becomes the highest aspiration of business. And as Ellen, you know, this is a celebration of what your founding fathers and mothers talked about when I mentioned Ben Franklin, the Philadelphia experiment. Or if you go back to England to the first king, William the Conqueror, 1066, and he conceives of something called a tally stick, a little wood-notched stick made of oak, which was the most stable form of money until 1834 when they decided, let's get rid of these. We've got this Bank of England, private central bank, and Queen Elizabeth, she can create her own credit and finance her own British East Indian Company and conquer North America, blah, blah, blah. And so we have the emergence of private central banks. When, in fact, you had the most stable monetary system probably in the entire world history, maybe, in Britain, called a tally stick, and guess what they did with them? They burned them in the House of Parliament, which created the Great Fire of London in 1834. It's like, how silly are you, burning the original form of stable money?
Karma.
So I work a lot with First Nations here. They had no form of money. They had two type of seashells. First treaty with George Washington was the Onondaga of upstate New York. It was called the Two Wampum Treaty. The wampum was a seashell sewn on buckskin or fabric representing money. And there were two forms of shells used, the Kauri shell and the Dentelia shell. The Kauri shell came from the only place it could come from was the South Pacific, from New Zealand, from the Maori, from Polynesia. And somehow it came here to North America. And they used those shells as a form of money. And no one remembers on what basis they traded. They had an economy, but they did not use coins. In fact, the ancient Taiwanese, where money emerged out of China, also used shells. So, again, I'm saying come on, we're smart enough. In the future years talking about where we may not need central banks, how do we have an economy that was based on something fungible like a seashell or a tally stick that's real assets? That's the question I'm posing.
You were mentioning about the accounting systems. I think you've written, and Hazel Henderson has definitely written, about how we leave out one half of the balance sheet. We don't count the things that we bought with all that money that we spent. In the Monetary Reform magazine of Canada, they're always talking about that human capital is missing from the balance sheet.
Right, Hazel
Henderson also says that we're not accounting for the thing that we produced with all that money that we say we're heavily in debt for. So for people like me that didn't get training in that particular aspect of economics, could you explain all that?
Basically, my point is we are not operating with a full balance sheet to the extent that we are not measuring our human capital. So that's our skills, our abilities, even our potential and dreams. You won't find that on the national balance sheet of the United States or Canada. And what could that look like? Actually, a lot of things. We have lots of data on educational attainment, intellectual property, people's entrepreneurial ventures, et cetera. Those are all forms of human capital. Some of them are built capital in terms of you produced a widget or a patent. So where are those in the balance sheet of the United States? I don't know. Does the Federal Reserve have that balance sheet? No. And then we have social capital. So what is that? Trust, relationships, feelings of belonging. Do you trust your neighbor, your local business? Do you have a regular accounting of those issues? Could you? Absolutely. And then my favorite, obviously, is natural capital, land, resources, water, the environment, ecological health. No accounting of that either, even though we know that's the fundamental basis of our Canadian U.S. economies. And then built capital, which is we know about. And then financial capital, which is, of course, the great fiction of all, right? So a properly constructed balance sheet would have an assessment of an inventory of those assets measured in physical qualitative terms, maybe market value terms. The liability,
I guess that's the part I don't understand, is how you would do it in market terms, like what your actual balance sheet would look like. You've got this $21 trillion debt on the left. Then what do you put on the right?
So here's the mind-blowing thought I've had. Who designed the double-entry bookkeeping system 500 years ago?
The bankers.
A Franciscan mathematician and monk named Luca Pacioli and his friend Leonardo da Vinci. In 1497, they wrote Divina Proportiona, which means divine proportion. It's the golden mean. Debits equals credit. So that was Luca's invention, and he was advising. Who was he advising? The Medici's. Right, so the first bankers coming out of Venice and Florence, and Luca said, this accounting system, which he probably borrowed from the Sumerians, like thousands of years before, said debits equals credit, as in nature, so in accounting, sacred harmony, Fibonacci. Like, wait a minute, how does a debit equal to credit in a ledger if you're not measuring the same thing? For example, can I measure trust against the existence of a tree? Well, the only way those things can be equivalent is if I monetize them.
Hmm.
Right? Think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But in physical accounting, I could tell you how many trees are standing, what kind of tree, how much 2x4s it would produce, and I can probably measure trust if I just ask people. But on a balance, on a debit equal credit basis, there's no way of equivalency. But I thought, that's interesting. They needed a monetary equivalent, right, expression to make those things balance. So that's our whole accounting system. But in the indigenous cultures where seashells were a proxy for what? Relationships, the health, the care, the buffalo or something. There was a more elaborate kind of system in which money really wasn't necessary to make things balance in the accounts.
I'm a bit stumped.
It's a fascinating idea that somehow an economy could be created in a world of such a technological and financial framing that we've got now. How realistic is it to talk about creating that kind of a balance sheet?
Go back to your the opening comment. Imagine a world without central banks. Imagine a world where we're each other's banker. Well, what does that mean? Nobody has a right, Walt, to say how you spend 1 hour of your 750,000-hour bank account that you were born with. So in a world where we're each other's bankers, where we're exchanging time, ideas, joy, love, you know, anything, what in a blockchain, crypto, smart contract world, could we actually become each other's bankers? Do we actually need any of these institutions anymore to regulate, to establish? Because in the smart contract language, this conversation right now is immutable, meaning there's a record. Yes, you're recording it, but there's a record of our relationship right now that is forever known. And so that becomes the basis of me calling in next time, because actually I like this interview. I trust Walt, and I'm going to be on the show again. So that becomes an asset. Now, what kind of system might we need to make all these transactions occur fluidly without the speculation, without the greed and stuff that enters into the system now? That's a fascinating question. I don't have an answer, and I'm not sure even we're responsible enough to even chart that path yet. But that's, I think, what's possible.
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with information and accountability and transparency. I mean, once you can see what everybody's up to, then, like, if we knew what all the Wall Street banks were doing, people probably wouldn't invest there.
Exactly.
Anyway, yeah.
I'm down, as they say, with the idea that money is about ultimately about relationship. A functional expression of relationship between parties. But that world is a different part of the economy than the world of our relationship on a personal basis, where I trust you, and you know. So there are two different realities, and the financial reality. Is your book not also trying to build in a practical application of the financial economy around the idea of well-being? No,
absolutely. So, you know, I work with communities, and I say, okay, let's go about, you know, town manager, you're an engineer. Let's construct this balance sheet for the town. So what do? We do a survey of people, how they feel about their life. We measure the state of the land and the forests and the wetlands and the infrastructure, right? We produce a proper balance sheet and inventory of the conditions of those assets. And now you develop your budgets, your annual operating capital and operating budgets based on, right, that assessment. Okay, that's one application. Cool idea, right? Okay, now what about Cincinnati invites me to talk about, can we create a community asset fund or maybe a whole new generation of community foundations that are investing in real local assets? You go to any community foundation in Canada or America and look at their portfolio and ask the question, what percentage of those assets, those equity investments, are in local assets? And just ask, like, listen to that response. And you say, really, why can't we invest more in our local assets, affordable housing, you know, solar panel, whatever it is, local food production? Because our local economies are starving for investment, and it's fleeing to Wall Street or other speculative finance managed by trustees who aren't really managing it in our interests of our community. So those are
right. Well, the argument will be that those are the more profitable investments, and they need those profits in order to pay out their pensioners or whatever the fund is for.
Oh, yeah.
But it makes no sense.
You know the language, right?
You've got this giant pool of money that's doing absolutely nothing but generating a few payouts for pensioners when the government itself, so like you say, a city is not going anywhere. It's not going to evaporate. Even if it goes bankrupt, it's always going to be there, and it always has assets, and it always has taxpayers. So it can always pay out that modest sum that it's going to require to pay the pensions for the pensioners. And say that $500 billion that California has in its pension funds could be being used for actually constructing stuff in the state, even if it isn't quite earning the same return that it's getting in Wall Street banks. And you can question whether it's getting a good return. If you chart it over like 20 years, you can see that they had huge losses in 2008, 2009.
So what I've done is develop a tool for accounting for the return on investment and well-being. measured, verified by people's own experience revealed in surveys, for example, that will tell me whether people feel better about their lives. People will tell me whether they feel better about their lives, more hopeful for their children, if you ask them and if you connect it to an investment that actually mattered to their life. These are the fundamental questions I ask.
This is very interesting because in so many ways, not only do we look at the changing our awareness about what the truth about money is, that it's really a relationship between people, but mm-hmm. that the system itself, the financial accounting system of scarcity built around managing some sense of limited access, is also changing, because you look at Norway and you look at Singapore and you see there's plenty of for everyone to go around, and that your economy of well-being apparently is going to depend on some sort of bestowance of sufficient financial means to
right.
express that, correct?
So yeah. I want to turn this discussion into this. This is a big challenge that I see. The three of us agree that money is, we can create as much money as we want. We could create gobs and gobs of money. In fact, one could say we have too much money sloshing around. In a future of blockchain and all this crypto world, where we can create just enough or just as little money as we want, perfectly calibrated to the well-being benefits of society, how do we do this? How do we carefully calibrate? Because no one should ever go to sleep at night anxious about money ever again.
How we do that is that we start to break down the presumptions that there's, A, not enough money, and maybe further examine for ourselves personally the inability of lots of money to create happiness and well-being.
Yeah.
You know, that inherent discovery is it's not going to cost us anything except some introspection, as well as a willingness to speak outside of the paradigm that we're all stuck in.
The problem we've had for 300 years is that we're up against a big private monopoly on the creation of money. And if we attempt to do anything independently of them, then they will say we're creating inflation. You know, if we just print our own money, we can't do that. It's unconstitutional or whatever. And they control the Congress, and therefore they control the laws. And so that's the major problem. But it seems to me we're back to social credit. We need to show that we can create money. We need money. We need lots of money in the local economy. We're short of money in the local economy. It will not hurt the local economy to pour some more money into it. We haven't done that yet, like even with quantitative easing.
We're talking about the democratization of money itself, and how are
right.
we going to achieve that?
And that, I gather, is the gist of your work, is that we need to re-examine, and the book, An Economy of Well-Being, we need to re-examine and changing our priorities.
We're moving in the right direction. We can't say there aren't examples and some working models, as imperfect as they may be. So that gives us hope, right? So we're not stuck. We just got to keep moving.
Well, Mark, congratulations and thanks for this discussion about your new book, An Economy of Well-Being, that it is possible that money can serve us in expanding our relationships and our capabilities in a way that eliminates the tyranny that we've subjected ourselves to.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you so much.
Mark Anielski's book, An Economy of Well-Being, is available from Amazon. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.